The next big event after Peenemünde is known as White Sands. White Sands had been selected here in the United States during the last year of the Second World War, but in the United States only one rocket, which needed a proving ground of roughly that size, had been built, namely the Wack Corporal. And the Wack Corporal actually was the first rocket to be fired from the White Sands Proving Ground. But then the White Sands Proving Ground, being only 120 miles in its long direction, which is from north to south, rapidly became too small because now the V-2s and Wernher von Braun had moved in. You were at Fort Bliss then, weren't you, Wernher?
Yes. I arrived in White Sands in October 1945, and the first half year I actually lived at the White Sands Proving Ground proper. Only thereafter we moved to Fort Bliss, which is only about 50 miles away, and there is nothing in Texas.
No, of course not.
So it was commuting distance. Our first activity, when I say ours, I mean mine and that of the 120 associates from Peenemünde, I was permitted to bring along to the United States, was to fire V-2s in White Sands. The purpose of the exercise was twofold. One was that the Army wanted to know everything about the V-2 and simply wanted to evaluate the V-2 missile to learn all about it. The second was that these flights, which due to the limitations of the White Sand range had to be high-altitude flights, rather steep trajectories, were an ideal tool to do some high-altitude research. And so the United States Army invited a number of universities to participate in this effort and to develop scientific payload packages that could be carried in the nose of V-2s to conduct measurements about the nature of the very high atmosphere.
Yes, I remember I saw number 14, which had been instrumented by Princeton University. Number 14, I don't know whether you recall the number offhand, unfortunately did not go to a high altitude, but put itself horizontal about 700 feet up and cruised over our heads.
Someone did it.
Which was very spectacular, I must say. It didn't do any good, but it was a beautiful picture. Well, but then after the V-2s were used up, I mean, the question then, which was discussed by everybody I know of, was should we in the United States build more V-2s or go on to something different? And I understand that you yourself voted in the direction of going on to something different.
Yes, the V-2, of course, by that time was an old workhorse, and it was certainly a good idea to start with a new concept and build an advanced missile rather than tooling up the V-2 for production again.
Yes, and the...
Nevertheless, the V-2 itself, of course, helped a great deal providing basic information for such advanced designs. For example, we built a two-stage vehicle consisting of a V-2 as a first stage and the Wack Corporal as the second stage, which cracked the world altitude record in 1949 by reaching an altitude of 250 miles.
Yes, that was Project Bumper.
Yes.
Number 5 was the one that went to 250 miles, I think.
Yes, it wasn't the first bumper.
It was not the first, it was number 5.
Yes.
And then number 8 and 9, of course, have another historical significance. They were the first two missiles fired from Cape Canaveral.
That is right. They were fired into slanting trajectories. The purpose of these two flights was not to go after high altitudes, but to measure heat transfer at very high speeds when these vehicles, the second stage in particular, traveled through the atmosphere.
Yes.
And they produced some very valuable data, too. I would say, by and large, this whole V-2 program in the United States was very gratifying for me, because in Germany, the V-2, for all its potential as a scientific vehicle carrier, was, of course, used as a weapon only, the country being at war. And this period in the United States, where a total of, I think, over 60 V-2s were fired, gave the V-2 a chance serving as a valuable scientific tool also, which had always been pretty close to our heart all these years, but we never had a chance of...
Now some research could be done with the thing.
Precisely.
And something fundamental could be learned.
Yes.
So then after the bumper, the two-stage vehicle, the first, to my knowledge, first two-stage liquid fuel rocket, where both stages were liquid fuel.
Was the bumper WAC.
Was the bumper WAC.
That's the V2 WAC corporal combination, yes.
After that, the next one was which?
Well, as far as our group's concerned, we are transferred to Redstone Arsenal, Huntsville, Alabama, where we are now. That was in the spring of 1950. And simultaneously with this transfer, we got a new assignment, namely to develop the Redstone liquid fuel rocket.
Yes.
The Redstone, as you know, is now in the hands of the troops. Several units are deployed in Europe under the NATO organization. And this was the first operational, the second operational liquid fuel rocket in this country. The first was the Corporal, which was an advanced WAC Corporal, but with a complete guidance system in it. And
an improved WAC Corporal.
Weaponized, as we say. It was transferred into a weapon which was never intended to be at the outset of the program.
No, because the WAC Corporal went the other way around. This was meant to be a high-altitude research rocket.
That is right.
And then turned into a weapon.
What happened was that when the Korean War broke out, the country awoke to the fact that we couldn't lower our guards anymore because the Russians had not demilitarized their army when the war was over. A guided missile czar was appointed in the Department of Defense, and he took stock of what capabilities he had, and he decided the weaponization of the Corporal would be the fastest solution to give this country a long-range weapon, and the second logical step would be to have our group develop the Redstone.
Yes.
And this is how we got the assignment.
And now the Redstone is still of a range comparable to that of the V2.
Yes.
A few hundred miles.
It carries a lot more payload weight, however.
Well, it's much bigger. I can testify to that.
Yeah.
But the next after that, then, is the Jupiter.
Yes.
Or was there anything in between?
No, we received the assignment to develop the Jupiter in 1955. Originally, it was supposed to be an Army 1,500-mile missile, but the operational use of this, that missile was later on turned over to the Air Force, but we continued the development nevertheless, and it's now being fielded by the Air Force.
Yes, and I found out that the public is confused between the Jupiter and the Jupiter C.
Well, that's a rather amusing story. In order to develop the Jupiter IRBM, the Jupiter 1,500-mile missile, efficiently, we had to solve the nose cone problem. That is, we had to come up with a design for the nose cone, or the envelope of the warhead, which would be capable of taking the severe aerodynamic heating during re-entry into the atmosphere. Now, there were two possibilities. Either we waited for the Jupiter missile itself to be available and used the Jupiter IRBM as a test carrier for its own nose cone. In this case, of course, any delays occurring in the nose cone development would have delayed the entire program. The other alternative would have been to come up with a temporary vehicle capable of also hurling some kind of a payload over 1,500 miles range and use this temporary vehicle to develop the nose cone parallel to the development of the Jupiter rocket itself. And this temporary vehicle could be a Redstone, which we had in those days, plus a two-stage solid rocket cluster in the nose of a Redstone. This vehicle had a capability of not throwing a 3,000-pound payload over the full 1,500-mile range, as the Jupiter could, but about one-tenth of that, namely 300 pounds. So you could make scale tests to develop the nose cone. Now, when we submitted this plan to the Department of Defense, we were told that this was fine and good, but the Jupiter enjoyed a higher priority than the Redstone, and I think they suspected us of sneaking the Redstone project into the Jupiter priority by proposing this. So they said, if you want to use some Redstones in support of the Jupiter program, you have to earmark those Redstones and give them somehow a Jupiter nomenclature so that we can identify them clearly and tell them from the rest of the Redstones which do not enjoy this priority. So we called it the Jupiter Composite Missile, and that's how the name Jupiter C came about.
I see there are not only engineering difficulties, but also legal fine points.
This is a case of political or legal engineering.
Yes, which have to be navigated through.
Yes.
But then the Jupiter C, of course, through the Explorer satellites.
Yes, this came about as follows. We had made several tests with this three-stage Jupiter C configuration in support of the Jupiter NOSCON development program when the Sputniks appeared in the sky. And then, as you will remember, our answer to the Sputniks at that time was the Vanguard missile, which was a very advanced and highly sophisticated vehicle, but was brand new at that time. Didn't have much testing on, and so to nobody's surprise, the early tests weren't completely successful.
Well, as a matter of fact, it was quite interesting that these preliminary so-called TVs, the test vehicles of the Vanguard, which were only one stage at a time, they all worked out nicely, but when the thing was put together, it stumbled over its own tail fins, which it doesn't have.
Well, this is usually what happens early in the program. Of course, when you work in a military missile program, you have the advantage that you don't have to advertise your failures so loudly as if you work in the glare of the public limelight by firing satellites.
Yes, well, I think we both agree that the main thing that was wrong with the Vanguard is that it was much too new.
Precisely, precisely. As later flights have demonstrated, the Vanguard was entirely capable of doing what it was advertised to do. And you give the Vanguard another 20 or 30 flights, and it'll be a highly reliable vehicle, too.
Yes.
But you just can't force these things. It still takes 9 months to get a baby, and the same goes for guided missiles, too. Only it's not nine months, but 3 to 4 years.
I was just going to say, only the gestation period is considerably longer.
Yes.
Well, now,
as a result of this, if I may hook on for your remark about satellites, as a result of the public pressure to put something up in orbit, the Department of Defense finally called us in and said, we understand your Jupiter C reentry vehicles have a satellite capability if you replace a nose section by a fourth stage, and it can still orbit something like 20 to 30 pounds. So let's get going. And with all the previous work already being completed, we were actually able to fire this first thing into orbit within 84 days from the word go.
Yes, I know you referred to it as in 80 days around the world.
Yes.
And, well, now, since we are talking about satellites, we're beginning to get into the future. There have been all kinds of satellites up so far. All sizes, shapes, different fuels having been used. And it is, of course, absolutely no secret. And I saw it here. It is no secret to the extent that I saw it in your Redstone morning paper this morning when I arrived here at Huntsville, Alabama, that you are coming up with something super colossal called the Saturn.
Yes. The Saturn is our first big step into the real high thrust area. Our ICBMs, which of course are substantially larger and heavier than even our Jupiter IRBM, still have a thrust, total thrust, of well under 500,000 pounds. Now the Saturn will have 1.5 million.
Yes.
It will be powered by 8 engines similar to those used in the Jupiter having, of course, only one of them.
Yes.
These engines will each of these engines will even give a little more thrust than the one engine in the Jupiter. So with eight of these engines, we have about 10 times more thrust of the Jupiter.
Mm-hmm. Coming out to about 1.5 million pounds.
1.5 million pounds, yes.
And then what is done with this depends, of course, entirely on what is put on top of this.
Yes. Now, we will put on top of it a Titan first stage. In other words, the whole ICBM, the whole first stage of the ICBM Titan.
Yes.
That's the second stage. And on top of that will sit a third stage, and if it's a high-speed deep space mission, maybe even a fourth stage.
If necessary, a fourth one.
And that can be tailored to the needs of the customer, so to speak.
Yeah, yes.
In this respect, we're quite flexible.
Well, yes, and this is what I like about this idea, that you have here a very heavy, very powerful first stage, which can carry almost anything desired, and it doesn't always have to be the same thing.
No.
With this ability to do almost anything the customer wants, what is the first objective?
Well, the very immediate objective of the Saturn project is to provide the transportation vehicle for a global communication system. Specifically, we are to fire 3 satellites into a 24-hour orbit in the equatorial plane. A 24-hour orbit is an orbit with an altitude of approximately 19,000 nautical miles above the surface of the Earth.
Yes.
If in the equatorial plane you fire such a satellite in the west to east direction, then the satellite will come to a standstill over a certain point of the equator. The Earth rotates about its axis also once in 24 hours. So if the satellite's period of revolution is 24 hours, it will be a relative standstill over a distinct point on the
equator.
Now, if you put 3 such satellites into the same orbit, all 24-hour orbits, all in the equatorial plane, and you space these 3 satellites 120 degrees apart in their orbit, then at this distance from the Earth, each of these satellites will be able to see the 2 others in an optical line of sight. At the same time, these satellites will be in permanent line of sight contact with a tremendous area on the globe. And in fact, there will be no point on Earth that is not in direct line of sight contact with at least one of them.
Yes.
That means if you want to make a telephone call, say, from New York to Paris, then one satellite may be in simultaneous line of sight contact with both New York and Paris, and you just send your radio message, your telephone, up to the satellite, and the satellite beams it back down onto Paris, and you speak in direct line of sight contact.
Yes.
With the satellite working as a kind of a repeater station.
Yes.
If you want to telephone, say, from San Francisco with Paris, where you may be too far away to see the same satellite, then San Francisco beams its message up to the satellite in line of sight contact from San Francisco.
The one they
can
see.
Yes. And that satellite beams it over to the other satellite that can be seen from Paris, and that satellite beams down to Paris. The advantage of this scheme is the following. There is no real difficulty in providing communications on the same continent. For example, if you want a telephone from New York to San Francisco, you can use the wires.
And you can even use multiple channel telephone
with carrier frequencies over the wire, and there are lots of connections. So there's no real problem in providing more traffic, more service for more telephone traffic. The moment you have to cross oceans, the situation is quite difficult and different. Either you have to put cables in the water, which is a very costly thing, and gives you only a few leads anyway, or you depend on low-frequency radio transmission, unless you want to go to ionospheric scatter radio, which is utterly unreliable.
Yes.
Now, that low-frequency radio communication presents you with the problem that the frequency spectrum is very limited. And even with all the tricks at our disposal today, such as single sideband, reception, suppressed carriers, and so forth, we simply cannot accommodate more traffic on that limited spectrum.
Yes.
But you are depending on these waves because they are the only ones who follow the curvature of the Earth. If you want to go to short waves and microwaves, you are limited by the fact that these waves, like light, propagate only along straight lines, and they do not follow the curvature of the Earth. But the frequency spectrum in that area is virtually unlimited because you can put a lot of frequencies very close together without interference. So you can, by establishing a communications satellite system where you beam messages up to the satellite and the satellite beams it back down to another point on the Earth, you can expand our present transoceanic telephone connections 100-fold or 1,000-fold without any great difficulties.
Yes, this scheme, of course, has been talked about in circles of space travel enthusiasts and rocket engineers for some time, but you say that this is actually the first use to which the Saturn will be put.
This is now an established program, and all the money we are getting for the Saturn comes out of this kitty. In other words, we are getting it for the specific purpose of providing this country with such a communication satellite system.
This, of course, is completely unmanned. This is a fully automatic system.
Yes, it will be a fully automatic system, but it's quite conceivable that as the need for more traffic increases, say if the television networks wants to pick up the idea and say, now we want to provide global television service with that same system, it may well be that the units going around there in that 24-hour orbit will become bigger and bigger, and finally you would may even want to have a maintenance crew up there. That's how people may still get into the act.
You mean simply by enlargement, and then at one time they get to be too large and too complicated to be completely trustworthy?
Well,
without maintenance.
I wouldn't put it this way. Suppose you have either three very large communication satellites up there or a great number of little ones, then you may reach a point where it may pay off to repair and maintain these things by sending manned repair crews out there or even having people live there more or less permanently to keep these things in shape.
Yes.
And a vehicle like the Saturn, of course, cannot only carry dead equipment up there, but it can very definitely also send manned capsules up there with repair crews that would be capable of returning to the Earth again.